Well, good afternoon, Mrs. This is the Dogs Program. We're here for public education. That is education that is public in purpose and outcome. Above all, it is public in access. It's open to everybody. And it should be public in ownership and control because it's the only one that is publicly accountable. And you don't have to be brilliant to understand that we are not in favour of the public subsidisation of the private sector. Now, up there in Canberra, there's a guy called Trevor Kobold who does lots and lots of facts and figures. And he has been looking at the funding for the next 10 years that Mr. Albanese says he's going to give to public schools, and it's not good enough. So, Andy's going to tell us about how the Queensland public schools are still going to remain underfunded despite any funding boost that Albanese has given them. Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Queensland public schools to remain underfunded despite funding boost. And this is an article written by Trevor Kobold from Save Our Schools, published on October 6. The claims by the Prime Minister, the Queensland Premier, and their education ministers that Queensland public schools will be fully funded by 2034 are a blatant falsehood. The new school funding agreement between the Commonwealth and the Queensland Government will not set public schools on the path to full funding, as government media releases say. Despite a substantial and very welcome boost in funding, Queensland public schools will remain underfunded in 2034, 23 years after the Gonski report recommended full funding. Public schools will remain massively underfunded in every year until 2034. It is a shameful neglect of the challenges facing public schools and the learning needs of disadvantaged students, the majority of whom attend public schools. In 2034, Queensland public schools will be funded at 97.6% of their schooling resource standard, SRS, instead of 100%. Public schools will be underfunded by $425 million in 2034. Underfunding will be over $1.6 billion a year in 2025 and 2026 and remain over $1 billion each year until 2032. The cumulative underfunding over the 10 years is estimated at $12.5 billion. Public schools also suffered massive losses under the previous Morrison-era agreement. There are several reasons for the continuing underfunding. First, the Commonwealth will increase its share of funding Queensland public schools from 20% to 25%, and it's only gradually phased in and heavily backloaded to the last 5 years. It will only increase by 0.5 a percentage point in the first 5 years. The increase over the first 5 years is estimated at $0.53 billion and $1.33 billion in the last 5 years. It will be reduced by only 1 percentage point by 2029. The cumulative funding loss from this accounting trick will amount to $4.7 billion over the 10 years. Second, the agreement requires the Queensland Government to remove the special allowance to claim capital depreciation up to 4% of their SRS as part of its share of funding public schools by 2034. This allowance was included in the previous Morrison-era agreement and defrauds public schools of funding because it is excluded from how the SRS is calculated. However, its scheduled removal is largely left to the last 5 years. The allowance will remain at 4% until 2029 and then gradually removed to 2034. The cumulative loss of funding from this accounting trick will amount to $4.6 billion. Third, the Queensland Government is allowed to claim other non-SRS expenditure as part of its share of funding public schools. It can continue to claim expenditure on the Curriculum and Assessment Authority, and it can now separately claim expenditure on school transport for public school students, which was previously included as part of the 4% allowance. It can claim up to 1.8% of the SRS for school transport, which the agreement admits is a non-standard inclusion. This is a remarkable admission by governments that these allowances defraud public schools of eligible SRS funding. The funding loss for public schools from all these non-SRS allowances will increase from $596 million in 2024 to $662 million in 2032, before reducing to $425 million in 2034. The cumulative loss of funding over the 10 years is estimated at $6.1 billion. The Queensland agreement discriminates against public schools by allowing the Queensland government to claim non-SRS expenditures as part of its share of funding public schools, but not for its share of funding private schools. Private schools are also subject to regulation, and private school students are eligible for school transport subsidies. Discriminatory defrauding public schools provides another resource advantage for private schools. The agreement must be revised to give public schools a better and fairer deal. The Commonwealth should accelerate the increase in its funding share of the SRS of public schools to achieve 25% by 2029. The Queensland Government should remove the 4% allowance by 2029 and immediately remove new non-SRS expenditure claims as part of public school funding. They certainly should. Back to you, Jane.
Well, thank you, Andy. And now we're going to go over to our counterpart in America. And Andy is going to read this article for us. Will teachers save our democracy?
Thanks, Jane. And now with some more US-based news. Will teachers save our democracy? This was written by Jeff Bryant and published in Counterpunch on October the 8th. With nearly every day presenting more evidence of America's eroding democracy, it's understandable to wonder whether a countervailing force will come forward to ensure, to paraphrase Lincoln, that the government of, by, and for the people will endure. Mass protests with catchy themes like hands off and no kings seem to offer more symbolism than substance. Court cases often fail to uphold key democratic provisions such as voting rights and press freedoms. The political party representing opposition to the current anti-democratic presidential regime is more unpopular than ever. Prominent political experts caution that campaigning to protect and uphold democracy isn't a winning strategy. And leading historians warn that the country is sliding toward fascism. But a new book suggests that a powerful force for democracy and against fascism is indeed at work every day, despite all that's being done to undermine it. And it's not in the halls of Congress, it's in public school classrooms. In her new book, Why Fascists Fear Teachers, Public Education and the Future of Democracy, President of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, Randy Weingarten, makes the case that democracy doesn't only happen when political candidates vie for office, citizens post their opinions on editorial pages and social media, and voters show up at the ballot box. Democracy is also at work, she explains, when public school teachers engage in the seemingly mundane tasks of educating students. Engaging in this work, Weingarten contends, has always made teachers a target for dictators, would-be and otherwise, who seek to undermine democracy and impose autocratic rule. Drawing from history, from stories of frontline teachers, and from her experiences as a former teacher, a champion for educators and a lightning rod for criticism from politicians in both political parties, Weingarten argues that public schools and teachers are inextricably linked with protecting democracy and ensuring its enduring presence in the nation's politics and governance. Weingarten's case comes across most vividly in her examples of teachers who resisted fascist dictators in 20th century Germany. In 1940, when Adolf Hitler's Nazi army invaded Norway, teachers were among the frontline resistance to the takeover, she recounts. They refused to join a Nazi-imposed teacher corps, even when German soldiers came into their schools and beat them. And when the Nazis eventually closed schools, teachers kept teaching students in secrecy. In Poland, when Nazi forces shut down an orphanage for Jewish children run by Henryk Goldschmidt, a Polish Jew who became a teacher and a prominent author of children's books under the pen name of Janusz Korczak, Goldschmidt continued to teach his students, staying with them even when they boarded trains to the concentration camp, after which he and his students were never heard from again. Another educator in the Nazi resistance was Lucy Aubra, a French teacher who helped to publish an underground newspaper and delivered communications and packages for the French resistance. Weingarten also tells of dedicated teachers in the US during the Jim Crow era of racial segregation who protested with their students the appalling conditions in schools black children attended. Their advocacy on behalf of their students helped bring about the legal actions that would eventually lead to the Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education ruling that made racially segregated schools illegal. Weingarten also recounts how former President Lyndon Johnson drew inspiration and insights from his experiences as a schoolteacher in a rural, impoverished community in Texas to press for his vision of a great society during his presidency. His political leadership eventually led to the enactment of numerous landmark progressive legislations, including the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In the present day, Weingarten writes about Claire Burke, an English teacher in Washington, D.C., who runs a journalism class where students report about real-world events and people. The students' reports often become national stories. She tells of Jeff Adkins Dutrow, a teacher and local AFT union leader in Peoria, Illinois, who brought together leaders from local businesses and the community to create an integrated system of career and technical courses to ensure students have career opportunities once they graduate high school. And she recounts how Lillian Keyes, a teacher in rural McDowell County, West Virginia, left her community to attend a university and earn her degree, but then returned to her hometown to teach in a community school that provides the county, which struggles with poverty, homelessness, and drug addiction, with education programs and nutritional support, healthcare, career education, and other student and family services. What makes teaching an inherently democratic act, according to Weingarten, is that it involves creating a shared public space that invites all children, regardless of race, income, religion, and ability, to engage in learning together, unencumbered by the prejudices and social hierarchies that fascism imposes. Teachers impart essential knowledge and skills to their students, such as the ability to communicate effectively, solve problems, and think critically about news and information, abilities that run counter to top-down autocratic government control. Teachers also create opportunities for their students by encouraging them to pursue their interests and dreams, and by providing programs and courses of study that prepare them for a future they, not government officials and big businesses, imagine for themselves. And teachers create agency, not only for themselves, but also for others, by organizing labor unions and other cooperatives and supporting democratically governed efforts to press for societal advantages, such as fair wages, positive working conditions, and government funding for public services, things that a fascist system beholden to billionaires abhors. Fascists and autocrats fear what teachers do because they know their brand of greed, hierarchy and extremism cannot survive in a democracy of diverse, educated citizens, Weingarten writes. So the authoritarian playbook always includes efforts to destroy the credibility of teachers and dismantle public schools. It would be good for other factions claiming to form the resistance to fascism to recognise the power teachers wield and to build strong alliances with them. But this is not always the case, as Weingarten alludes to when she mentions neoliberal Democrats who have intentionally or unwittingly aided the right in their agenda to destroy public schools. In addressing that faction, Weingarten briefly mentions prominent Democrats who have promoted a market-based approach to education policies, such as Arne Duncan, the former CEO of Chicago Schools and former Secretary of Education under President Barack Obama. She calls Duncan a prime example of someone who bought into the idea that public schools would miraculously work better if they were run like corporations. And while she roundly criticizes the rollout of school vouchers and hails their defeat in states such as Nebraska and Kentucky, her take on charter schools, a darling of the neoliberal agenda, is more nuanced. She recalls her previous support for the idea of charters, but also expresses her disappointment that charters often lack accountability, pick and choose their students, and operate like businesses more focused on market competition and profit rather than the needs of children and their education. Because of her nuanced take on charter schools, ardent supporters of public education might come away dissatisfied that Weingarten doesn't name more names in the neoliberal faction and highlight more of the actions they've taken to prepare the ground for right-wing factions to privatise education. But clearly the aim of the book is to build solidarity among opponents of fascism rather than promote intra-party factionalism at a time that solidarity seems more important than ever. Her call for this solidarity makes the book a good read for those who may not closely follow education policy and politics, but who welcome some hope and encouragement that they are not alone in their resistance to autocracy and are allied with a deep and broad coalition that includes millions of practicing educators and public school employees. Why fascists fear teachers is also a much-needed reminder of why the United States, since its founding, has made public schools fundamental to the well-being of its people and the success of the nation. During a time when prominent Republicans are calling for public education's demise, Democrats often respond with vague, uninspiring arguments about why public schools are needed to overcome inequality or economic competitiveness, instead of rousing voters to a cause that goes back to the origins of the country. For this reason, those who follow political rhetoric will want to see how Democrats, who are ramping up their campaigns for the 2026 midterm elections, take lessons from Weingarten's book to heart. And I'm sure there are many parallels in Australia. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, teachers are abroad, and aren't they important? But let's have a quick break from all of this.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Yes, well, we hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program, because we're pro-public education. Some of our young people who go to university have got big hex debts. Unfortunately, Australia always seems to pick up the bad habits of the UK and the US after them. So we thought that our listeners would be interested to hear about how Trump officials are considering selling student loan debt to private investors. There was talk about forgiving the loan debts, weren't there? But anyway, over to Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article is entitled, Trump Officials Reportedly Consider Selling Student Loan Debt to Private Investors. Experts say the move could eliminate the federal government's power to cancel educational loans. Officials in the Trump administration are reportedly weighing the possibility of selling portions of the federal government's $1.6 trillion student loan portfolio to private investors, which experts say could carry risks for both taxpayers and borrowers, potentially reshaping the student loan landscape in unpredictable ways. Senior officials at the Education and Treasury Departments have been engaged in internal conversations about offloading select, high-performing segments of the government's student debt holdings, according to a Politico report this week. These loans are part of the larger portfolio owed by roughly 45 million borrowers nationwide. Administration officials have also reportedly reached out to figures in the financial industry, including potential buyers, to discuss the idea. The deliberations, which began earlier this year, initially included Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, officials stationed at the Education Department, but are now being guided primarily by senior political appointees. It's unclear how far the administration will take the idea or which parts of the $1.6 trillion portfolio could be put on the market. Daniel Zibel, Vice President and Chief Counsel at the National Student Legal Defense Network, described the proposed loan sale as a complex and unprecedented idea, essentially the reverse of the 2008 financial crisis, when the government bought privately held loans to stabilise the market. The system for student debt is incredibly complicated, and for the administration to do this in a way that lives up to the protections that exist in the law for student loan borrowers makes it even more complicated, Zibel said. Selling them off now, he said, would shift repayment and management responsibilities to private entities, raising questions about enforcement, oversight, and the continuity of borrower protections. It could also eliminate the government's power to cancel the loan. If you're talking about unilateral cancellation, like what President Biden had been talking about, the department would certainly lose all authority to tell a private company that they had to cancel a debt, he said. The sale proposal aligns with the administration's broader goal of reducing the federal footprint in student loan system and encouraging more private sector involvement. It could also explain why the Trump administration was so eager to roll back the loan forgiveness offered by the Biden administration. Now we know why President Trump and Secretary Linda McMahon are hell-bent on squeezing every last dollar out of families with student debt, Mike Pierce, Executive Director of Protect Borrowers, said in a statement. Once again, we see that all across the Trump administration, when Wall Street's demands run against the financial needs of working people, the banks get what they want. Michelle Zampini, Associate Vice President of Federal Policy at the Institute for College Access and Success, says the plan is likely linked to the Trump administration's broader ideological aim of shrinking or dismantling the Education Department. This is all part of the same conversation, because the department manages this huge billion-plus dollar loan portfolio, Zampini said. You can't really wind down the department while still having responsibility for this type of loan portfolio. It's driven by their desire to wind down the department more broadly. This is the roadblock in their way in many senses. Any attempt to sell off federal student loans would raise major legal and logistical questions. Borrowers could face uncertainty about whether current consumer protections, often more favourable than those offered in the private market, would remain intact. It's also unclear whether the government would continue to guarantee the loans. Zampini adds that the move would put borrower protections at particular risk. Because there's really no precedent for this, there is no indication that there is, first of all, interest from the private market. And if there is interest, their interest would be likely to squeeze as much profit from the repayment as they could, she said. And so the interest of a private purchaser and a private investor would very likely not be to provide borrowers with any type of generous benefits or relief programs. This is not the first time the idea has surfaced. During Trump's first term, the Education Department hired consulting firms to evaluate the student loan portfolio and estimate its potential sale value. That analysis revealed the loans were worth substantially less than government accountants had assumed, and the plan was shelved as the COVID-19 pandemic upended the economy. Now, with Trump back in office, the administration appears to be reviving the concept as part of a broader rethink of the student loan system. Officials are reportedly exploring whether to transfer management of the loan portfolio, or segments of it, from the Education Department to the Treasury Department, an idea seemingly consistent with Trump's stated desire to close the Education Department altogether. I don't think this is driven by an interest in helping borrowers, Zampini said. Certainly, I don't think it's driven by an interest in improving the program. And I don't think it's driven by an actual interest in saving taxpayers' money. I think it's driven mostly by a political interest. The potential sale is only one part of a sweeping effort to overhaul the student loan system. The administration has allegedly rolled back nearly all Biden-era policies that offered loan forgiveness or expanded repayment options. It has also resumed collecting defaulted loans for the first time since March 2020, when the pandemic prompted a nationwide pause. Still, it's not completely clear how feasible these plans are under the current legal system. The law does specifically allow the Secretary of Education to work with the Treasury Department to sell loans, Zabel said. But it very clearly says the Secretary has to determine that it is in the best interest of the United States to do so, but also that there will not result in any cost to the federal government. The concerns are not just that current borrowers might be at risk of losing their protections, But the student loan market controlled by private entities would increase the barriers to attend college. The federal loan program is unique because the loans are not originated with the goal of making a profit on them, Zampini said. They are essentially an access tool to enable people to go to college who wouldn't necessarily be able to access that same credit in the private market. All of those factors make them a lot less likely to generate a return for an investor. And so it's hard to see how someone looking to make a return on these loans, on this portfolio, would do anything but increase as much as they can the amount of payment and decrease the relief programs and the flexibilities that the federal government offers. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Sorrel, and I hope that the young people here in Australia fight to have their debts forgiven. But we're going overseas now with our expert, Jeff. He's going to take us there. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Now, we're going to the United States, where just in the last week, during the government lockdown, the government has taken the opportunity to sack another 4,000 or so federal employees, over 430 of them from the Education Department. So that's in addition to the earlier 1,300 or so who were sacked early part of this year. And this article comes from ProPublica, and it's written by Megan O'Matz and Jennifer Smith-Richards. It begins, "Under Trump, the Department of Education has been bringing in activists hostile to public schools. It could mean a new era of private and religious schools boosted by tax dollars and the end of public schools as we know them. These activists want to dismantle public schools. Now they run the Education Department." And that's actually the title of the article. "Education Secretary Linda McMahon has been clear about her desire to shut down the agency she runs. She's laid off half the staff and joked about padlocking the door. She calls it the final mission. But the department is not behaving like an agency that is simply winding down. Even as McMahon has shrunk the Department of Education, she's operated in what she calls a parallel universe to radically shift how children will learn for years to come. The department's actions and policies reflect a disdain for public schools and a desire to dismantle that system in favour of a range of other options, private, Christian and virtual schools or homeschooling. Over just 8 months, department officials have opened a $500 million tap for charter schools, a huge outlay for an option that often draws children from traditional public schools. They have repeatedly urged states to spend federal money for poor and at-risk students at private schools and businesses, and they have threatened penalties for public schools that offer programs to address historic inequities for black or Hispanic students. McMahon has described her agency moving at lightning rocket speed, and the department's actions in just 1 week in September reflect that urgency. The agency publicly blasted four school districts it views as insubordinate for refusing to adopt anti-trans policies and for not eliminating special programs for black students. It created a pot of funding dedicated to what it calls patriotic education, which has been criticised for downplaying some of the country's most troubling episodes, including slavery. And it formed a coalition with Turning Point USA, Hillsdale College, PragerU, and dozens of other conservative groups to disseminate patriotic programming. Officials at the Education Department declined to comment or answer questions from ProPublica for this story. At times, McMahon has voiced support for public schools, but more often and more emphatically, she has portrayed public schools as unsuccessful and unsafe, and she has said she is determined to give parents other options. To carry out her vision, McMahon has brought on at least 20 political appointees from ultra-conservative think tanks and advocacy groups eager to de-emphasise public schools, which have educated students for roughly 200 years. Among them is top advisor Lindsay Burke, a long-time policy director at the Heritage Foundation and the lead author of the education section in Project 2025's controversial agenda for the Trump administration. In analysing dozens of hours of audio and video footage of public and private speaking events for McMahon's appointees, as well as their writings, ProPublica found that a recurring theme is the desire to enable more families to leave public schools. This includes expanding programs that provide payment in the form of debit cards, which Burke has likened to an Amazon gift card, to parents to cobble together customised educational plans for their children. Instead of relying on public schools, parents would use their allotted tax dollars on a range of costs: private school tuition, online learning, tutors, transportation, and music lessons. More than 8 in 10 elementary and secondary students in the US go to a traditional public school, but Burke expects that public schools will see dramatic enrollment declines fueled by both demographic and policy changes. Addressing an interview in an April podcast, she noted, "We're going to have a lot of empty school buildings." And in a speech last year, she declared, "I'm optimistic, you know, that 5 years from now, the majority of kids are going to be in a private school choice program." In a 2024 podcast, Noah Pollack, a senior advisor in the education department, bemoaned what he sees as progressive controls of schools, which he said has led to lessons he finds unacceptable, such as teaching fourth graders about systematic racism. "And so the work that I do is trying to come up with creative policy ideas to stop that, to turn back the tide, to figure out ways that conservatives can protect these institutions or build new institutions," said Pollack, who has been an advisor to conservative groups. "As tax dollars are reallocated from public school districts and families abandon those schools to learn at home or in private settings, the new department officials see little need for oversight. Instead, they would let the marketplace decide what's working using tools such as Yelp-like reviews from parents." Burke has said she is against any sort of regulation. President Donald Trump himself said in July that the federal government needs only to provide a little tiny bit of supervision, but very little, almost nothing, over the nation's education system, except to make sure students speak English. Advocates for public schools consider them fundamental to American democracy. Providing public schools is a requirement in every state constitution. Families in small and rural communities tend to rely more heavily on public education. They are less likely than families in cities to have private and charter schools nearby. And unlike private schools, public school districts don't charge tuition. Public schools enroll local students regardless of academic or physical ability, race, gender, or family income. Private schools can selectively admit students. Karma Kwikpanwala, a leader at the Disability Rights Education and Defence Fund, which advocates for disabled students, said she wants to be optimistic. "But," she added, "I'm very fearful that we're heading for a less inclusive, less diverse, and more segregated public school setting." Alison Rose Sokol, a policy expert at Ed Trust, an organisation focusing on civil rights in schools, decried what she called the demo crew in McMahon's office. Sokol described McMahon's push to help grow private school enrolment through taxpayer-funded vouchers and other means as a great American heist that will funnel money away from the public system. "It's a strategic theft of the future of our country, our kids, and our democracy," she says. Attention on McMahon often focuses on her former role as CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment. It is no different on the day of her Senate confirmation hearing, when journalists and social media delighted in noting that seated behind her was her son-in-law, the retired wrestler known as Triple H. Little attention was paid to the conservative education activists in the front row from Mums for Liberty, which has protested school curricula and orchestrated book bans nationwide. Defending Education, formerly Parents Defending Education, which has sued districts to fight what it calls liberal indoctrination, and the America First Policy Institute, co-founded by McMahon after the first Trump administration. Now, two people who once served at Defending Education have been named to posts in the Education Department, and leaders from Mums for Liberty have joined McMahon for roundtables and other official events. In addition, at least 9 people from the America First Policy Institute have been hired in the department. The AFPI's sweeping education priorities include advocating for school vouchers and embedding biblical principles in schools. It released a policy paper in 2023 titled Biblical Foundations that sets out the organisation's objective to end the separation of church and state and plant Jesus in every space. The paper rejects the idea that society has a collective responsibility to educate all children equally and argues that the Bible makes it clear that it is parents alone who should shoulder the responsibility for their children. It frames public schooling as failing, with low test scores and far-left social experiments such as gender fluidity. The first AFPI leader pictured in that report is McMahon. AFPI and other two non-profit groups sprang up only after the 2020 election. Together they drew in tens of millions of dollars through a well-coordinated right-wing network that has spent decades advocating for school choice and injecting Christianity into schools. Ultra-wealthy supporters include right-wing billionaire Richard Ouellette, who through a super PAC gave $336,000 to Mums for Liberty's super PAC from October 23 to July 24. Defending Education and AFPI received backing from some of the same prominent conservative foundations and trusts, including ones linked to libertarian-minded billionaire Charles Koch and conservative legal activist Leonard Leo, an architect of the effort to strip liberal influence from the courts, politics and schools. Maurice T. Cunningham studied the origins and connections of parents' rights groups, finding in 23 that the funders, a small set of billionaires and Christian nationalists, had similar goals. The groups want to undermine teacher unions, protect their wealthy donors from having to contribute their fair share in taxes to strengthen public schools, and provide profit opportunities through school privatisation, he concluded. The groups say they are merely trying to advocate for parents and for school choice. They didn't discuss their relationship with donors when contacted by ProPublica. These groups and their supporters now have access to the top levers of government, either through official roles in the agency or through the administration's adoption of their views. When the department created an NDEI portal to collect tips about diversity, equity and inclusion initiatives in schools, it quoted Mums for Liberty co-founder Tiffany Justice in the press release. She encouraged parents to share the receipts of the betrayal that has happened in our public schools. Mums for Liberty referred to the portal as the culmination of the justice's work. Federal judges ruled against some of the administration's anti-DEI actions and the department took the controversial portal down in May. Asked what percentage of children she imagines should be in public schools going forward, Justice, who is now with the Heritage Foundation's political advocacy arm, told ProPublica, "I hope zero. I hope to get to zero." She and others say most public schools don't teach students to read and are dividing children over race and are secretly helping students to change genders, familiar claims that have been widely challenged by educators. When Trump signed an executive order in March to dismantle the Education Department, Justice sat in the first row as she had at McMahon's confirmation hearing. The president praised her, along with various governors and lawmakers. "She's been a hard worker," he said. Defending Education's Nicole Nelly, who was also at McMahon's confirmation, stood next to McMahon when the secretary announced an investigation into the Maine Department of Education for keeping records from parents about student gender identity plans. Defending Education has filed civil rights complaints against colleges and school districts and has been successful in having its causes taken up by the Trump administration. In an email, Neely told ProPublica she is proud of the work that Defending Education has done to challenge schools that have supported DEI and their curricula and have allowed students to hide their gender identity from parents. She singled out teacher unions and radical education activists while blaming drops in student achievement on the education industrial complex. "The sooner this stranglehold is broken, the better," she wrote. McMahon's tenure has also been marked by an embrace of religion in schools. She signalled that priority when she appointed Meg Killigan to a top post in her office. Killigan has worked in the department as a director of faith initiative during the first Trump term and was once part of the Family Research Council, an evangelical think tank that opposes abortion and LGBTQIA plus rights. She has encouraged conservative Christians to become involved in what she's described as a spiritual war over children and what they're being taught in public schools. "This is why we have to lead as Christians, because what the left is doing is a top-down imposition of an agenda of a Marxist and anti-God and anti-family agenda," Killigan said in the 2023 Summit on America's Schools. Reached by phone, Killigan told ProPublica, "I have no comment," and hung up.
Thank you so much, Jeff. We're going to have to end that there, but we would encourage you to read the entire article at the ProPublica website. It's by Megan O'Matts and Jennifer Smith Richards. The activists who want to dismantle public education are now running the Education Department. Over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. We've got some good news stories now. We're going to hear about how Australian teachers are resilient, even amid the very intense pressures that they have in the classrooms. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Australian Teachers Resilient Amid Intense Pressures Report. And this was written by Brett Hennebury and published in The Educator on the 13th of October. The Teaching and Learning International Survey, TALIS, 2024 study shows that while Australian teachers are working an average of 46.5 hours per week, well above the OECD average of 40.8 hours, less than half of their working week is actually spent teaching children. Yet almost two-thirds report experiencing high stress, with more than 80% saying their job negatively impacts their mental health. The report also confirms that Australia is now among the top three OECD countries for teacher shortages in public schools, a finding that Australian Education Union AEU Federal President Karina Haythorpe called unacceptable for a wealthy developed nation. We urgently need national action to fix the teacher pipeline, from recruitment into initial teacher education to retaining experienced teachers in classrooms, Haythorpe said in a statement. The TALIS data also shows that shortages are most severe in schools with high levels of student disadvantage and special education needs, which are the very schools that rely the most on stable, experienced teaching staff. When students with additional needs or from disadvantaged backgrounds are most affected, the result is a deepening equity divide in Australian education, Haythorpe said. Green shoots amid the pressure. Professor Teresa Dick from the Institute of Positive Psychology and Education at Australian Catholic University said the latest TALIS survey presents a familiar but complex picture of Australian schools. Teachers report high workloads, administrative burden, and intensifying expectations. Yet the same data also shows a profession characterised by strong professional identity, high job satisfaction, and sustained commitment to students and colleagues, Professor Dick told The Educator, adding that these findings sit alongside positive national trends. Applications for initial teacher education programs are up around 7%, while offers are up 14% nationally, and at ACU, enrolments have grown sharply, including a 41% rise at the Brisbane campus for Semester 1 2025. Professor Dick also noted that employment-based routes such as the All Points to Teaching APTT program, co-funded by ACU and the Commonwealth, and the government's High Achieving Teachers Initiative, are also drawing new entrants from other sectors. Together, these indicate modest recovery in supply and broader access to the profession. The tension, however, lies between supply and sustainability, Professor Dick pointed out. TALIS confirms that workload volume and task complexity, rather than individual resilience, drive teacher strain, she said. This aligns with evidence from the 2024 ACU Principal Health and Wellbeing Survey, which identifies role overload and administrative demands as key stressors across leadership and teaching roles. In both data sets, supportive leadership, collegial trust, and opportunities for collaboration predict stronger well-being and retention, Professor Dick said. These are systemic conditions, not personal traits. Graduates well prepared for core teaching. Australian evidence also challenges the notion of a broken ITE pipeline, Professor Dick said. Most graduates report feeling well prepared for core teaching tasks. The larger gap is in ongoing professional learning once teachers enter schools, she said. Referring to the Monash Australian Teachers Survey 2023, Professor Dick said while many teachers value professional development, they question its relevance and accessibility. Sustained, practice-based mentoring and collegial learning opportunities remain central to early career retention, she said. Professor Dick said findings from the ACU's own analysis of TALIS data further emphasise the central role of the school environment and motivational quality in sustaining job satisfaction among both teachers and principals. Across countries, satisfaction was consistently higher where schools were collegial, orderly and participatory, and where leaders promoted trust and professional autonomy, she said. Conversely, environments dominated by compliance, top-down decision-making, or limited voice predicted lower satisfaction and higher strain. Professor Dick said these patterns reinforce that well-being and motivation are shared organisational responsibilities rather than individual attributes. Flourishing teachers need time and trust. Looking ahead, Professor Dick said several priorities are clear to ensure that Australia's teaching workforce is properly supported. teachers' time must be protected by reducing low-value administrative tasks and safeguarding collaboration and mentoring time, she said. Additionally, it is important to scale employment-based routes with quality, ensuring structured coaching and induction. Professor Dick also pointed to the importance of strengthening professional learning that targets key classroom challenges, such as behaviour and differentiation. Support must be given to school leaders to build and sustain climates of care through coaching and workload relief, she said. If current green shoots in recruitment are matched by renewed attention to workload, mentoring and school climate, Australia can move from short-term recovery to a more sustainable teaching workforce, one that allows educators not only to enter the profession, but to remain and flourish. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you. That's a very interesting article. But now let's find out what makes an award-winning student wellbeing program. Once again, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. What makes an award-winning student wellbeing program? And this was published in The Educator on the 13th of October and written by Brett Henneberry. Ask any teacher why they took up the job, and rarely will you hear them mention remuneration, extra holidays, or recognition. Indeed, the altruistic desire to see a young person succeed and go on to become a happy and well-adjusted adult is what keeps most teachers going, even as the massive pressures of the job take their toll. Perhaps the most complex pressure that teachers deal with is the youth mental health crisis. According to an April 2025 survey by the University of Adelaide, nearly one-third of secondary students and more than one-quarter of primary students experienced high levels of depression or anxiety symptoms in 2024 alone. Worryingly, many more students reported moderate levels of mental distress, raising concerns about their vulnerability to additional stressors. At Logan Lee State High School, south of Brisbane, staff go above and beyond to make sure that every aspect of the student experience is not only enjoyable, but makes them feel seen and heard. A sense of belonging at the core. The school's approach recognises a growing body of research showing that students with a strong sense of belonging are happier, have better self-esteem, cope better with challenges, and report a lower level of bullying. Belonging is also one of the strongest predictors of attendance for Year 7 students and students from low SES backgrounds. By 7:30 a.m, Logan Lee students and staff line up at the Brekkie Club for free toast, cereal and milk, an early ritual emblematic of a school where student wellbeing is interwoven into the tapestry of everyday life. But free breakfast is just a single ingredient in Logan Lee's comprehensive wellbeing program. On campus, a dedicated wellbeing hub offers a one-stop shop of support from youth workers and guidance officers to a nurse, psychologist, chaplain, and even a visiting GP. Guided by core values of respect, integrity, and resilience, Logan Lee's holistic approach goes above and beyond what most schools offer. And it appears to be paying off. While many Australian schools are doubling down on their wellbeing initiatives, Logan Lee has seen standout results, including improved attendance and half as many students leaving without a post-school plan. At the Australian Education Awards 2025, on Friday the 8th of August, Logan Lee State High School's inspirational work was celebrated and recognised on the national stage when it won the Parent Shop Best Student Wellbeing Program. In an interview with The Educator at the event, Hayley Cravigan, General Manager of Parent Shop, said the company sponsored the award because wellbeing sits at the heart of what Parent Shop does. It's personally very important to us, Cravigan told The Educator. We run wellbeing programs, and we're so inspired by the educators that lead those programs in schools, the innovations they come up with, and the dedication they have to go above and beyond just teaching and do the foundational skills for life learning, which is looking after student wellbeing. Keeping it real. Kevin Roy, Dean of Year 10 at Logan Lee State High School, said the school's holistic approach to student development is driven by a deep commitment to personalisation and real-world readiness. Logan Lee State High School aligns all aspects of school life with our core values of respect, integrity, and resilience to develop future global citizens, Roy told The Educator. We make a significant investment in understanding the needs of each individual, as well as the diversity of our student body, to create weekly structured lessons tailored to each year level. Roy said the inclusion of guest speakers and community partners ensures students are regularly exposed to real-world learning experiences. Early intervention in career planning enables students to explore their options, gain essential knowledge, and be well prepared for life after school. Small school, big heart. Roy said being a smaller school allows staff to be more actively involved in the individual success of each student. School leaders invest time in building strong relationships with students by being visible in classrooms and during breaks, he said. Understanding our students' needs and actively listening to their voices drives our annual improvement agendas and wellbeing programs. Roy said student-led projects, such as the newly developed welcome pathway at the school entrance, reflect the school's diverse community. This initiative brings together the many cultures of our school by greeting visitors in over 60 different languages. Not content to rest on its laurels after winning the Parent Shop Best Student Wellbeing Program, the school's wellbeing program will be continually evolving to meet the needs of its students. One exciting new initiative is the launch of Care Class mini projects, where each care class is challenged to develop a practical solution to a real issue within our school community, Roy said. Through the project, students will identify a problem faced by Logan Lee, investigate the issue, and propose a viable solution, developing a pitch and supporting communication demo materials, and present their pitch to a panel for feedback. Roy said students can choose to focus their projects on sustainability, resourcing, student wellbeing, or connection to community. This initiative empowers students to take ownership of their school environment, develop critical thinking and teamwork skills, and make meaningful contributions to school improvement. Back to you, Jean.
Well, there's no surprise about our great state school for the week, but let's hear again from Andy.
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools.
School of the week.
School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Logan Lee State High School. And here's the principal's statement. Our beautiful school is set on 56 hectares of pristine riverfront land, making our school grounds the second largest in Queensland. Combine this with the fact we are relatively small in population, and you have a fantastic setting for children to thrive. Our mission is making a difference for every student. We do this by inspiring students to reach their true potential in three critical areas by developing the skills and knowledge to live a healthy life, both physically and mentally, outstanding character that models our school values of respect, integrity, and resilience, and writing, inquiry, collaboration, organisation, and reading skills to prepare students for a successful life beyond school, including further education and employment. We aim to cater for all students' interest areas and therefore offer a range of excellence programs. Our motto at Logan Lee is "To the Stars," and our excellence programs are called STAR programs, in line with the school motto. Our STAR programs aim to inspire students to reach their true potential at school by embracing students' interests. Our STAR programs include agribusiness. We have a fully operational farm and business partners which help prepare students for a career in the field of agribusiness. Hospitality. We have a multi-million dollar hospitality trade training centre and links with industry partners that help prepare students for a career in the hospitality industry. Logan Lee Institute of Sport. The Logan Lee Institute of Sport includes four different programs: football, soccer, rugby league coming soon, netball, and athletics and sports general for students that do not have a strong interest in the above three sports. The Logan Youth Development Lifesaving Program, developing students' leadership skills in the context of surf lifesaving. We have a strong relationship with Kira Surf Lifesaving Club, where students attend excursions and camps to become fully qualified surf lifesavers. Signature Academic Excellence, a program for students that have a strong desire to achieve academic excellence and gain direct entry into a university pathway. Dance, extending students' repertoire, performance and skills and confidence in the field of dance. Music, a program for students with a love of music. And Digital Innovations, a program for students wanting to turn their interest in gaming and technology into a career in the future. Our great school is well known for its caring and supportive approach to education. This care factor, a culture of high expectations, the broad curriculum offerings available to students, and our unique STAR programs provide students with an outstanding, well-rounded education. I encourage you to read through our prospectus, and I look forward to being an integral part of your child's education. I encourage you to visit our school and experience the Logan Lee Advantage. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The enrolment is currently 897, and the ICSEA value is significantly below average at 932, representative of a diverse country community. The upper 25% of parental incomes make up 3% of students. The second level, 12%. The third quartile, i.e. below 50% of parental incomes, makes up 28% of students, and 57% of students have parents in the lowest 25% of incomes, with 27% speaking a language other than English and 11% Indigenous students. The recurrent grants from the Australian Government are $4.09 million and the Queensland Government $14.6 million. Private fees and contributions add $367,000 and other private contributions add a little under $24,000. That comes to $23,882 per student. The capital, $3.293 million over 3 years. This is a school doing an amazing job on every front. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Logan Lee State High School up there in Queensland. And we hope that you'll stay listening to 3CR, but above all, come back to the Dogs program next week. But if you want to find out more about us, we're there on the website at www.adogs.info. But from our wonderful producer, Dale, and from her offsider, Andy, and Sol, and Jeff, and myself, it is goodbye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. Sir.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.